Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Everyone must determine, how do I need to vote? What do I need to do? And now is the time to do it. Do I need to get my mail-in ballot? Do it. Do it today.
A rallying cry from former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch in an exclusive interview. Then, COVID gave the world a chance to fix the climate crisis. Are we wasting it? I'll ask veteran Senator Harry Reid and teenage activist Alexandria Villaseñor as they unite the generations in a new documentary. Plus,
career officials have a flag that they may find serious errors in this data.
Our Hari Srinivasan talks to journalist Hansi Lo Wang about the threats to this year's census count.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. From her birth in Greensboro, North Carolina, to rising to become America's chief law enforcement officer, Loretta Lynch made history in 2015 as the first black woman to be U.S. Attorney General. The rule of law has been central to her remarkable journey to the top. During her career, she's tackled everything from soccer and FIFA officials to fraud, terrorism, and police violence. All of this makes her really ideally placed to navigate this particularly turbulent time. As Americans on the streets demand racial justice, a showdown is underway over the Supreme Court, and Democrats are criticizing the current Attorney General, Bill Barr, for politicizing the Department of Justice. I asked the former Attorney General about the perils and the pitfalls that she sees ahead at today's annual CNN Citizen Forum. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, welcome to the Citizen Forum. Can I just first start by asking you what many Americans are talking about now, and that is the passing of a great legal mind, a trailblazer, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. You yourself are a female trailblazer. Just your personal reflections on that and on what it means to the country.
It's a tremendous loss to the country and to the legal field. She was a leading light. So much has been said about her. But I will have to say that one of the ways in which she was most impactful for women lawyers in particular was that she never shied away from how hard it was to balance her family, her children, her profession. She never denied the fact that it was difficult, challenging, but worth it. But she took that experience and she transposed it across the forum of the law and showed how when the law works to make things unequal, that's when we all have to step in. So she didn't just use her personal experience as sort of an inspiring story and try to get everyone to essentially follow her. She used it to show that there were times when the very structure of our legal system was designed to push people out of equality and make life not only difficult, but fundamentally unfair.
I want to ask you, because, you know, this all comes up in the context of equality, rule of law, democracy, also comes up in the summer of discontent over the uprising for racial justice. This talk is about seeking justice, trying to redress inequality in the United States. You yourself grew up in North Carolina. You experienced racism yourself. In fact, your mother tells quite an alarming story about a particular high school test you once took. Can you take that away and just tell us what you were confronted with?
I think she's actually referring to an elementary school test that I took. And after I took the standardized test, I was asked to take it again. I took the test with everyone else in the room. And then about a few weeks later, I was pulled aside and said, you know, there was some problem with the paper. It didn't get scored and I had to take it again. And I took it in a room by myself, which I thought was just odd. But when you're in fourth grade, you believe what your teacher says. when I told my mother about this, she became more upset than I'd ever seen her, really. And she reached out to friends of hers in the administration, and they said, well, because I had scored so high on the standardized test, there was a belief that it could not have been my work. So they forced me to retake it, and I scored about 10 points higher without the distractions of the other kids. And that type of unfairness truly bothered my mother. She was an educator, she was a teacher and a librarian, and that kind of overlooking of potential talent in anyone, which was clearly based on race, particularly in North Carolina in those days, was something that went against everything that she stood for. And to link it back up to Justice Ginsburg, you know, she also illustrated through her life what it meant like to be dismissed because of her gender. You know, to think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg could not get a job out of law school, you know, it's unthinkable today, but it was the norm then. To think that a young Black child scoring well on a test wouldn't be celebrated at a time when schools want to have that kind of result for their children is unthinkable now, but it was very, very common when I was young. And so, you know, we're talking about not just a justice, not just my own experience. We're talking about what is the fundamental vision of law and equality in this country.
Your successor, Attorney General Barr, said in June, I think there's racism in the United States still, but I don't think that the law enforcement system is systematically racist. Well, clearly this is a huge focus, certainly in the Black Lives Matter movement, and just the ability to try to make the criminal justice system fair. What is your reaction to that statement from the Attorney General?
Yes, you know, I did see that statement, and I think that it's very typical of individuals who, because their life has been one, has had a different path than many other people, they have not had to experience racism, they've not had to deal with systemic racism, they're not able to see it. And honestly, on a personal matter, that would be fine. But when you are the Attorney General of the United States, when you are the leader of the Department of Justice, the only cabinet agency named for an ideal that is about equality, that is about recognizing that everyone in this country does not have the same experience, I think it's honestly tremendously sad, and it's a missed opportunity by the Attorney General to truly understand the people whom he is supposed to and sworn to protect. So I was quite disappointed to hear that statement coming from him, because when you sit in that chair, one of the things you learn early on is that you have to take into account the experiences of all of the people in this great country. And the reality is, all of them do not experience justice in the same way that Attorney General Barr did growing up where he did and how he did. There are a number of people in this country, there are scores of people, even millions of people in this country, for whom justice has not been about pushing them forward. It has been about holding them back. And that's what the law has meant to them. What I do find heartening, however, Christiane, is the unrest that we've seen over the past few months. Not the violence, let me be clear. The violence that we've seen that accompanies many of these peaceful protests is not helpful. It does not advance the message of equality. And in fact, it gives people further ammunition to push people back and keep them apart. But when people come together and share their lived experience and talk about how in this country, as great as it is, the justice system still is not serving them, that's an important message and it has to be heard.
And it's important to say that all the measurements and all the polls and all the investigations show that a massive proportion, more than 90% of the protests, have gone off peacefully and that there has not been violence. So just to make that clear. I want to also ask you, because we're going to talk about racism and the election, voter suppression and the like. One of the key issues for the American people, if not the key issue in this election, is about health. It's about COVID. It's about the management of the coronavirus crisis. As we know, 200,000 deaths plus now in the United States. It is the worst death toll in the world. I want to ask you again, this is about what Attorney General Barr has said, comparing COVID lockdowns to slavery. Let me just read this. Putting a national lockdown, stay-at-home orders, is like house arrest. Other than slavery, which was a different kind of restraint, this is the greatest intrusion on civil liberties in American history. So I want to know what your response is. Obviously, there wasn't a national lockdown in the United States. But your response to those words and how it, you know, deals with the idea of the greater good versus individual freedoms.
You know, again, just a tremendous missed opportunity by the Attorney General. And just, if you want to talk about the greatest intrusions on civil liberties, I think it's unfortunate that he places health restrictions designed to save lives and keep us safe above, for example, the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, the atrocious treatment of Native Americans throughout generations in this country. I think that those would stand far and above health restrictions designed to save our lives. And in fact, we have a way to, in fact, ensure our freedoms. Wear a mask, follow the CDC guidance, and we will all be able to engage in the freedoms that we so cherish in terms of our mobility around this country. So I frankly put no stock in that comment, to be quite honest with you. And I think if you are talking about the institution of slavery, I find it fascinating that the Attorney General recognizes the detrimental nature of slavery, but for some reason cannot see the badges and incidents that flow today in the form of systemic racism in our society. And again, I think I find it fascinating when people who have had a certain kind of background take it upon themselves to define racial issues and racism for those of us who have actually lived that experience and have probably a closer view. And that's why I think that this our summer of discontent, as you call it, has been so intense. The combination of those issues, I think it has shone a light on these issues of inequality for so many people. And it has pulled people into the situation where they might have been able to say, you know, inequality is an issue that's really limited to racial minorities. It doesn't impact me. Well, the pandemic has really put everyone at the same level. And I think it is akin to the civil rights movement when we had the exposure through the press of the horrors that were happening in the South that really opened people's eyes to what it meant to be a marginalized person in our society. We are seeing that same recognition again today. A lot of it is because of the police violence that we've seen, the video of George Floyd losing his life in front of all of us, but also seeing the veil of security ripped away from so many Americans, I think has really opened a number of people's eyes. And that's why we're at a crossroads in this country. We have to choose what kind of a country do we want to be.
Okay, so one of the major, you know, elements of that choice is rule of law, it's shoring up democracy. And, you know, it's something that, again, certainly from sitting over here in the UK and watching it from overseas, people are quite, you know, asking quite a lot of questions about the commitment of the United States to the rule of law. And as you know, everybody knows in the United States that Attorney General Barr has been somewhat under the spotlight recently and accused in some quarters of politicizing the Justice Department. You obviously held that position for a long, long time. So let me just a couple of the things. Overriding the sentencing recommendations for President Trump's ally Roger Stone, directing Federal Prosecutor's Office to withdraw the government case against Michael Flynn, and taking on President Trump's defense in the legal case of E. Jean Carroll, who says the president sexually assaulted her in the 90s and recently defamed her. He says, Attorney General Barr says, no, I'm not politicizing it. It's within my power to be the final arbiter, which it is, according to the rules. Do you agree that it is within his power? What do you make of the way the Justice Department is being run at the moment in this regard?
You know, I think that the one of the beauties of the Justice Department is there is a tremendous amount of power that is rested in the Office of the Attorney General and throughout the Department of Justice. And it needs to be wielded in a way that is responsible and in a way that inspires trust and respect for the rule of law. That is so easily lost. My fear is that while AG Barr may be able to look at technical rules and say, well, I'm within my rights, I'm within my power, it's not just what one does, it's how one does it. You know, how is the Department of Justice being deployed? And if, for example, the Attorney General is going to reach into cases and have an impact, is that done across the board? I think there are a number of individuals who are languishing in prison today who would welcome the Attorney General looking at their case and saying, you know, was this sentence too harsh? Were the mandatory minimums inappropriately applied in my case? Is there a view that there should be a more moderated or modulated way of looking at these types of crimes? But unfortunately, that's not what we are seeing. We are seeing the Attorney General deploy his power in a very focused way. And frankly, I think there have been discussions where he's been asked, have you deployed these powers in cases where there were no connection to the president? And I don't believe that he was able to provide examples for that.
So elections generally determine, as you said, the direction of the country. There's a massive, it's more than 60%, according to the latest poll, who believe the country's in the wrong direction right now. But even the election itself, the vote itself, is being undermined by the administration. President Trump has even floated the idea of having external law enforcement monitors at various, you know, ballot boxes, etc. What is your hope or your nightmare scenario about how this election goes off and how the result will be tabulated and enshrined?
You know, I have a great deal of faith in the American people overall. And it's not to say that our systems are perfect or that this isn't a tremendously difficult time, perhaps one of the most difficult times in our democracy since the Civil War, when we were deciding again, what kind of a country did we want to be? What ideals did we want to advance? I do think that people are focused on this election in ways in which they have not been in prior elections. And that's on every side of the political divide. I do think that voting should be open and accessible, regardless of party affiliation and regardless of whom you vote for. As a country, we need to ensure that everyone has the ability to vote easily and to vote in a way that's consistent with their beliefs. And so I think people are going to be focused on this election. I believe that they are going to be energized by the issues in this election. It has touched people's lives in ways that I've not seen really in generations. So it's beyond the issue of just, do you believe that Black Lives Matter? It's, do you believe that we all have a fundamental right to equality in this country, to fairness in this country? Do we believe that we should determine how law enforcement interacts with our citizens in this country, that we can hold people accountable and yet still have fairness in the system? And so I have tremendous faith in people, but I do think it is vital that people understand what is at stake in this election and find a way to make their voice heard at the polls. We have seen voter suppression really for generations. We've seen it since the passage of the Voting Rights Act, Christiane. Since that act was passed, there has been a concerted effort over the years to find a test case to overturn, if not the whole Voting Rights Act, salient portions of it. And that's what we saw several years ago in the Shelby County v. Holder case. Opponents of fair access to the ballot had been looking for a test case for years, and they found it in Shelby County, and they were able to eliminate the preclearance requirements, where the Department of Justice had to scrutinize changes to voting in certain states to ensure that they did not impact minorities unfairly. And as soon as the preclearance section was removed, we saw a raft of state-sanctioned efforts to limit voting, ranging from voter ID to limiting access to the polls. And we see that today. We can never underestimate those do not want change and do not want to share power in our country. And we can never underestimate the means to which they will go to try and hold on to power. That is what politics is all about. And I know that everyone says I'm not political and they're not into it, but we have to assess the impact of politics on our daily lives. Everyone must determine, how do I need to vote? What do I need to do? And now is the time to do it. Do I need to get my mail-in ballot? Do it. Do it today. Do I need to make sure that my registration is up to date? Do it and do it today. Do I need to make sure that I have a way to get to the polls with the pandemic? Figure it out and figure it out today. Because this is the most important thing that any American ever does, is decide the fate of our country.
On that note, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, as Governor Gavin Newsom of California says about the wildfires ravaging his state, if you're in denial about climate change, just come to California. New research shows that despite a fall in emissions during the global lockdowns, the world is still running behind its already insufficient targets to limit global warming. A new season of Earth Focus on Southern California's KCET looks at the global politics swirling around the environment and the climate crisis. Here's a clip.
5 years ago, this was a place that was a couple miners, and it eventually became the hotspot of illegal gold mining in the Amazon.
So we've got a toxic mess of an environmental disaster, social decay, and you're left sitting with what looks like a post-apocalyptic nightmare.
We can't separate the climate crisis from other socioeconomic problems. The government and countries have to be held accountable.
Now, the series features activists from different generations, including my next two guests. 15-year-old Alexandria Villaseñor became an activist after witnessing the worst wildfire in California's history in 2018. And former Nevada Senator Harry Reid, former Senate Majority Leader, made environment a focus of his decades-long career. And they are both joining me now. Welcome to the program. I'm just going to say it. You are an unlikely couple, but I'm really interested in getting your generational views of this big, big issue. Senator Reid, I don't think many people associate your decades-long career in politics with the climate. What is it that brought you, or how would you reflect on your career in politics and the climate?
When we gave my papers to the University of Nevada, the archivist came back a few months later and said, it's remarkable, over half of the papers deal with the environment. And as I look back, I spent a lot of time dealing with the environment. I felt strongly from the time I was a little boy, when I watched a place that was close to my hometown of Searchlight. It was a paradise. There was water. There was lily ponds, big trees. After I finished college and law school and went back to look at it, it had been trashed, trees burned down. There was an old fort built during 1864 to protect the railroad, the mail routes to California, that knocked down the fort. So I have been someone since then who have been interested in the environment in many different ways. For example, in Nevada, Nevada is the most mountainous state in the Union, except for Alaska. 362 separate mountain ranges. We have 32 mountains over 11,000 feet high. We have a 14,000-foot mountain. So I am really interested in the environment, and that's why when I was elected to Congress, we had a few thousand acres of wilderness. Now we have 5 million acres of wilderness. What is wilderness? It's leaving the land and the way it was when Earth was created. No mechanized vehicles can come on that land, and I'm happy that I was able to do that. I have in Nevada, we have a mountain, we have called Basin and Range, which is almost 1 million acres of protected land that President Obama did. We have another national monument real close to Las Vegas to keep people away from the national treasure we have there dealing with petroglyphs. So the environment to me has been very, very important in my career.
Okay, I'm going to ask your co-star in this series, your co-activist in this series, Alexandria Villaseñor. You know, what do you say to somebody of Senator Reid's generation? You're a young activist and you came at it as a young girl. And many in your generation have harsh words for us and for our forebears in terms of how we're leaving the earth and the climate for you. What brought you to this, and what about this cross-generational bridge?
My activism actually started out of my experience with the Paradise Fire back in 2018. My home community experienced that fire, and after that, I joined Greta Thunberg in the Fridays for Future movement. And I started a weekly climate strike in front of the United Nations headquarters that went from December of 2018 all the way up until the pandemic. Now, though, looking at what's happening on the West Coast, it's even more important to be an activist because climate change is here and the West Coast fires have drastically exceeded what occurred in 2018. So we are already seeing the effects of the climate crisis. unfortunately, the generation that will be most impacted by the climate crisis yet, we can't vote. And I'm only 15, so I have 7 more years until I can vote. So I'm worried by the time my generation can vote, it will be too late, because we are already seeing the drastic effects of the climate crisis. Because after decades of inaction, it's also become clear to us that older generations have become complacent, and young people have to force the conversation about climate change. That's why it's important for us all to take these different actions to make our voices heard right now.
So let me throw it back to you, Senator Reid. You know, she can't vote yet. People like her are really concerned about this. Climate has been a big, big political issue for young people for a long time. You know, from your experience, your long and, I mean, I don't know, grizzled experience trying to get this through politics where it actually matters, what do you think? Where do you think we're headed? Because any number of people, any number of states, any number of cities can take climate action, which they do. But without big government buying into it as well, how far can one get to save the world for people like Alexandria?
I gave speeches on and off the Senate floor, and I would say, people are going to look back at us and say, what were you doing? I mean, we are still have many, many coal-fired power plants in America. Get rid of them. We don't need coal. It's a thing of the past. Yet we have a president who's, every place he goes, he trumps how, I guess that's a play on words. But he talks about the importance of coal. The importance of coal is it's ruining our environment. We have to get away from fossil fuels. And young people are driving this. Alexandra, I'm so proud of you and those young people who feel this more than anyone else, because you're going to feel the detriment that's taken place in our country. All we need to do is look at the forest fires in California. Look at that. We have four major storms developing in the Atlantic as we speak. It's never happened before. So keep it up. It's up to you young folks to make sure that you don't let up, take your foot off the gas. Push.
Well, that is really exceptional advice. And the thing is, Alexandra, you guys have been doing that. I mean, the Greta Thunberg school strikes for the climate, I think you were inspired by her as well. And if I'm not mistaken, you have filed a complaint with the United Nations against powerful countries that have not met their targets and their pledges. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yes, so actually, as of yesterday, it's the 1 year anniversary of a complaint that I am a part of. And so the complaint was filed to the Committee on the Rights of the Child by myself, Greta Thunberg, and 14 other children from all around the world. And what we're saying is that 5 countries are violating our rights as children by their inaction on the climate crisis. And so those countries are Argentina, Brazil, Germany, Turkey, and France. So the reason why it were those countries, some people say, well, why not the United States? Well, the United States did not ratify the rights of the child. And so this complaint is also bringing attention to what countries are committed to actually upholding these rights. And so the reason why I think that this illegal action is very important is because it shows we are holding all of these powerful countries accountable. And so legal actions, I'm seeing so much more young people are standing up and doing this because they see what's happening to our planet, and it's unfair that we are being given this. And so we are seeing lawsuits by children in Canada and Mexico, and now there's even a Portuguese lawsuit by 6 children who have taken their fight to the European Commission on Human Rights. So young people are rising up and really demanding action from all different sectors of our society, and legal actions is what we're focusing on with this.
You know, it is very exciting the way you put it. I just want to ask you, because I think you were born and raised in California, and now you live in New York. Is that because, I mean, did your family move because of health and pollution issues?
Actually, so I was born and raised in Northern California, but in 2018, I ended up moving to New York City while my mom pursued her master's. But I still go back and forth quite a bit. I was actually in California at the beginning of the pandemic, and so my whole climate story started because of California's wildfires. And my climate story happened in 2018 after the campfire. And it feels like we are seeing a repeat of history with so much, with all of these environmentally fueled climate change disasters. And so one thing that I've been really paying attention to, I ended up having to come to New York City. Actually, the past couple of weeks, I ended up coming back here after being in California because I was sheltering there. But after these weeks with the recent fires, it was more safe to be here. And it's so upsetting because people in California, with these fires, they don't know how to keep themselves safe. We don't have enough information about how to keep ourselves safe from when these disasters strike. And so, for example, I saw people going outside without the right masks that keep out those smoke particles. And that can cause health issues in the future if you don't keep yourself safe from the smoke. The fires are seeping into people's homes. People don't know how to seal up their home to keep themselves safe. And so we're seeing the effects of the climate crisis because it's not just a climate crisis. It's not there's just not enough public health information. So this is a health crisis as well when it comes to climate change. You know
what? It's terrifying to see the picture. Sorry, Senator Reid, go ahead.
Here in Nevada, where I live, it rained for the first time in 137 days.
Wow.
And usually when it rains in the desert, you get this smell that is so stunningly unique, but not now. In this beautiful rain, you didn't smell the desert rain, you smelled smoke. So it really, really put a damper on enjoying a rain that we had, first one in 137 days.
It's incredible. I want to ask you also, Senator Reid, about the Green New Deal. Green New Deal as proposed by the progressives in Congress, and what you, I think, have referred to, or people have referred to your activism as lowercase Green New Deal. In other words, you've dealt with it as a matter of pragmatism. Can you explain how you managed to, you know, get the changes that you achieved, get them through, in many times, a partisan political atmosphere?
Well, they came about in a number of different ways. On occasion, I had to be really hard. In fact, one time, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was really upset. So I woke up my negotiator on the big omnibus bill we were going to do. And I told him, when you meet with McConnell in the morning, you tell him, I get renewable tax credits for solar, or I won't sign on the deal, and we will get no omnibus spending bill. And we got it done that way. Sometimes you have to throw your elbows around a little bit. Other times you have to work with everyone else and try to do it a different way. But there's no single way, in my opinion, that I was able to get some things done for the environment. I am very happy with what we've been able to do with protecting the environment. It's just something that is important to my children, my grandchildren, and their children.
And do you think, I mean, Vice President Biden has made the climate with his $2 trillion proposals for it, front and center of his election campaign, obviously health and healthcare as well, COVID management. Do you think that's going to be possible? Are we going to see, let's say, there is a President Biden ahead, perhaps a Congress that will be, I don't know, Democratic? Do you think that it's possible to move this political ball along in an accelerated fashion?
I think this is going to be a change election. I believe that Biden will be elected a nice margin. Pelosi will build upon her margin that she has in the House, and we're going to retake the Senate. We're going to win in Colorado, Montana, Maine, North Carolina. We have a real good shot in the one seat in Georgia. We're going to win in Arizona. As we speak, we're ahead in Iowa. We're going to pick up the seats we need to have a majority in the Senate. We do that. We've got a Democratic president, got Pelosi in the House, and we've got Democratic majority in the Senate. It's the time to do some really stunningly important things. And one of the things they're going to have to take a look at, I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but as to when we get rid of the filibuster. Filibuster is not a question if it's going to be gone. It's only when it's going to be gone.
Can I just ask you, since you raised filibuster, it's a little bit controversial because as we talk about the nomination potentially happening very, very soon for the Supreme Court, there are some who say, you know, maybe you removing that filibuster sort of led to this ability of the majority just to have 50 plus one, I think it is, to get their nominee through. Do you regret that?
I'm so glad you brought this up. During Obama's first term, first Congress, they filibustered everything. They filibustered, for the first time in the history of the country, the Secretary of Defense. They made it so that National Labor Relations Board could not have a quorum. They couldn't have a meeting. Obama could not get his cabinet, sub-cabinet officers filled. The D.C. Circuit, the second most important court next to the Supreme Court, had seven vacancies. So had I not done what had been done times before, changed the rules with a simple majority vote, Obama would not have gotten his cabinet officers. We wouldn't have taken care of the D.C. Circuit, the National Labor Relations Board. We were able to have the Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, we passed because of that. We passed the most significant change in the history of Wall Street, in the history of the country, with the Dodd-Frank legislation. So I'm glad you brought it up. It was one of the most important things done for the country. And I'm glad I did it 1,000 times over.
All right. Let me ask Alexandria now, because I want to play a little clip from the doc. And this is about a couple of your fellow activists talking about their specific challenges. And it's from places like Litokni Kabua, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Carl Smith in Alaska. Here we go.
The waves came and then they removed the piece of land that used to be over here. So over here used to be our outside bathroom. And then it was knocked away.
The permafrost is defrosting and it's not hard enough for the waves to hit. And usually when the waves hit, it just bounces off and it doesn't erode. Nowadays, it's just too soft and it's just breaking down the dirt on our land.
So Alexandria, I know there's a lot of work ahead. There's a lot of bleakness out there, but there's also, you know, you and the activists. Are you optimistic?
I think that optimism is definitely a main motivator behind what we do. Young people in this past couple of months during the pandemic have really come together even more than we have. We have reflected and now we are using social media and we're organizing and we're making up new ways of taking action than what we have done before. See, we plan to use more online organizing in this movement, using different platforms. You're going to see more young people using TikTok to their advantage, like what they did with the Tulsa rally. And so as well, we're going to use more education and educating each other around environmental justice and equitable solutions, continuing to push the media accurately on the climate crisis to make sure that mm-hmm. when they cover disasters like the California wildfires, they mention climate change because that is a climate-fueled wildfire. And so we are going to continue doing more legal actions as well. We are not going to stop until we make our voices heard. I think that what gives me the most hope is seeing our actions and us coming together as this global movement of young people.
Okay, well, it's great to hear you say that and your commitment and your optimism. Alexandria, thank you so much. Senator Harry Reid, thank you very much indeed. And Senator Reid's documentary, The New West and the Politics of the Environment, airs next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Pacific Time on KCET. And in October on PBS stations nationwide, that's where that'll be, you can see all the episodes of Earth Focus on the PBS app. We turn now to another pressing issue, though, with long-term consequences, the United States Census. Each decade, the census attempts to count every person living in America and its five territories. That data then influences everything from voting districts to how many electoral college votes a state gets to where federal funding goes. President Trump has long pushed to include a citizenship question in the census, which would effectively exclude undocumented migrants from the count. That directive was rejected by the lower courts, but today the administration has asked the Supreme Court to reconsider. Hansi Lo Wang is a national correspondent for NPR who reports on the people, power and the money behind the census. And here he is speaking to our Hari Srinivasan about the importance of this 2020 count.
Thanks, Christian. Hansi, just so we have an overall importance of the census, I mean, sometimes people say, well, why is this discussion even happening? What are the consequences? What happens after an official census count?
What happens is the country decides how it redistributes power and money for the next 10 years, specifically how many seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, those 435 seats, how many seats each state gets for the next decade. That's dependent upon the latest state population counts that are determined by the U.S. Census. That's number one. And then that also has a direct impact on how many electoral college votes each state gets for the upcoming, not the one in November, but the one after that presidential election. And the one after that, two presidential elections, the power that each voter has in determining who is the next president, that is determined by these census numbers. And beyond that, in 2021, states have to redraw voting districts, those political maps that determine what voting districts representatives, all the way down to school board members, what districts they represent for the next 10 years. That's supposed to happen next year. That's based upon the census numbers. And money, there's a lot of money at stake here. $1.5 trillion a year are distributed. This is federal funding, federal tax dollars are distributed based in part on the population counts. And this is funding for Medicare, for Medicaid, for other public services, including roads, schools. It's really hard to overstate how influential this set of numbers is.
Now, it takes a long time to count every person in the United States. How long has this count been going? Where are we at in that process?
This count officially started in January. I was in the Alaskan fishing village where it started, Tuksuk Bay, southeastern coast of Alaska. And it traditionally starts in the most remote places of Alaska. That's the best time to try to find folks and make sure they're home and they can be counted. And the count then continues on for a good part of the year. Because of the pandemic, that has been extended. This count was supposed to end the counting end of July. The Trump administration then pushed it back to originally the end of October. Now it's set to end a month early because a change that the Trump administration has made at the last minute, end of September. And so it's a greater part of the year at this point because of the pandemic, because as you said, it is a hard job trying to count every person living in the country.
Now, you just wrote a story recently looking at internal emails, and one of the emails points out from career staffers, basically, that we need all the extra time that you guys extended. Don't make it shorter.
This is a career official saying they really need every single minute that was part of this extended schedule that the Trump administration originally approved and asked Congress for support for. This is back in April, a month after the coronavirus pandemic was declared a national emergency by President Trump. President Trump publicly supported it. And for more than 3 months, the Census Bureau has been operating as if it had this extended schedule to continue counting through October 31st and not have to deliver those first set of results until next year, 2021. But at this point, Congress has not passed any laws extending that reporting deadline. And so December 31st is the deadline that the Census Bureau is working towards right now to try to get those latest state population counts. But there's this tension here that internally, Census Bureau officials have been really concerned that this shortened time period, that this having to meet that December 31st deadline means that one of these internal documents say fatal errors, fatal problems with the data quality, that they could possibly produce results that would be deemed unacceptable for use, that they could be so inaccurate that researchers, local and state governments may file lawsuits, may raise enough concerns that it could really jeopardize all the processes that happen after the census, the reapportioning of congressional seats, the redrawing of voting districts, as well as all the other uses of this really influential data.
You know, when you talk about data accuracy, it seems that there's always almost this ecosystem of academics and researchers that all rely on this, but how do we double check to make sure, or how do we error correct, so to speak, and where is that process this year?
Well, the Census Bureau always has these months built in their schedule. After the counting ends, the census is really not over. The public doesn't see door knockers anymore after the counting is finished, but there's a lot of work happening at the Census Bureau headquarters and as well as other processing centers. They are going through these results, all the results that they've collected. Some of them are duplicate responses because people may have forgotten that they already filled out the census online and filled it out again, or maybe you have someone counted in multiple households. These are all very frequently seen scenarios that the Census Bureau tries to find and try to correct for. And the Census Bureau originally had about between 5 and 6 months to do this under this extended schedule that it was working under. Right now, under the shortened schedule the Trump administration has ordered it to follow, just about 3 months. And the concern here is that internally, the Census Bureau career officials have flagged that they may find serious errors in this data. After the counting is finished, they go through these results, they might find serious problems and not have enough time to fix them. And so we may have to be living with a count, a set of numbers that have potentially serious errors for the next decade.
So how many states are on track versus who or not? I don't know which number is bigger.
Right now, the latest numbers that I've seen, that you only have 3 states that have hit a goal mark that the Census Bureau has set, which is 99% of housing units enumerated. That's the goal that they have set for every state as a marker of accuracy and of quality. And so far, the latest numbers I've seen, only 3 states have hit that mark.
Who is most affected by the undercounting?
Most affected are people of color, are immigrants, renters, rural residents, young children under the age of 5. These are all historically undercounted groups that decade after decade, the U.S. Census has not had accurate numbers of. And this is based upon the Census Bureau's own research, where they send out teams to figure out what is the undercount for these different groups. And it has found that there has been this persistent problem that the population numbers that the Census Bureau collects each decade overrepresents white people and underrepresents Black people, Latinx people, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, American Indians. This is a persistent problem, and it has major implications on who gets political representation and who gets federal funding, who gets what share of that is distributed, and whether or not that is done in a fair way based upon the actual population of the country.
You know, in addition to the pandemic, we've also got in parts of the country hurricane after tropical storm after hurricane, and then another part of the country we've got wildfires. We've got people moving all about during this period. We've got people who've stayed in the same place since March, and they might not have gotten their census envelope in the mail to fill out or gone online to do it yet, right? I mean, how does the census correct for all of that in basically an additional, what, we have just a little more than a week left?
This is the major challenge facing the Census Bureau right now. The time is running out based on this current schedule, and these are all scenarios that really are keeping a lot of Census Bureau workers up at night because some of them are very hard to try to work around. You know, one major looming issue is in this middle of this historic hurricane season, as well as these devastating wildfires hitting the west along the west coast right now. These could potentially develop into showstoppers in certain areas, meaning that in-person counting cannot take place possibly in these areas at a time when the Census Bureau is actually about to roll out a really major part of operations. This is a counting of people experiencing homelessness, something that was supposed to happen in late March. The first day of April has been pushed back because of the pandemic, and there's only one slot to do that according to the current schedule. It's this week for 3 days just before the census counting is supposed to end. So if there aren't any major storms, any major conditions because of wildfires, for example, that may prevent the counting of people experiencing homelessness, that could really raise a serious conundrum for the Census Bureau. How do they reschedule that given this very short time frame that they have?
So what's the role of the administration been in all of this? You've been following this for several months now. There was this sort of debate over whether or not the citizenship question should be included. It was decided that it was not going to be included, but there's still a lawsuit pending. Explain that to us.
There are multiple lawsuits pending. I've become a legal reporter on this census beat. The administration has made a number of decisions that have been challenged in the courts. Like you mentioned, the courts have decided, the Supreme Court has decided, it cannot add a question about U.S. citizenship status to the forms. That's generated a lot of attention. There are lawsuits over the Trump administration's decision to abandon its extended timeline for the census and to shorten it, to end counting a month early. We'll see how those play out. There are hearings scheduled for this week. And then there are another set of lawsuits I'm tracking, and they have to do with a presidential memo that President Trump issued in late July. It's a memo that has since been blocked by a three-judge court in New York, but there are other legal battles going on. This is a memo that is calling for unauthorized immigrants to be excluded, not from the census in general, but specifically from the numbers used to determine how many seats in the House of Representatives each state gets, what's known as the apportionment count. And this memo is being issued despite the 14th Amendment's requirement. The 14th Amendment of the Constitution requires that count to include the whole number of persons in each state. But the Trump administration says that they want to exclude unauthorized immigrants from that number, and they are planning to appeal this ruling, this latest ruling from the New York court, three-judge panel in New York, all the way to the Supreme Court. So this is going to be ongoing litigation that will be happening in the final, certainly the final weeks of the census counting and through the end of the year, likely.
So if I'm understanding this correct, the Trump administration's argument is that you should not, if you're not a legal resident of this country, you should not count in the number of representatives from your state. You are a person, but you shouldn't be a citizen and count towards that larger number.
It's a little bit more nuanced than that. The Trump administration, again, to be very clear, the census is still counting every person living in the country, regardless of citizenship status, regardless of immigration status. That is still happening. The Trump administration is making an argument that the president has discretion to determine who is included specifically in this count that determines how many seats in the House of Representatives each state gets. But a three-judge court in New York has ruled that this has not really been a topic really for discussion, that the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, says the whole number of persons in each state. Congress has passed laws related to that requirement set up in the Constitution to say the president has to hand over essentially the total population, the whole number of persons in each state as determined by the census to Congress, so that Congress can carry on that process for determining how many seats in Congress each state gets. And ultimately, the president plays a limited role in this process. One thing I do want to point out here is that the Trump administration has said they haven't figured out a way yet how to do that, how to exclude unauthorized immigrants from the census count. And experts that I've talked to, census experts, say there is no, practically speaking, there is no legal way to do that. The reason is because the census form does not include any question about a person's immigration status. So the Census Bureau ultimately has to create a set of estimates, and we'll have to use statistical sampling, which the Supreme Court has already ruled cannot be used when we're talking about the count used to reapportion seats in Congress.
So regarding the influence of the administration in all the documents and the emails that are becoming public as part of these lawsuits, and that really you're one of the few people on the planet who's probably read them all, is there a direct line between the White House and the people at the Census Bureau? Any influence, any phrases that have been left out or highlighted?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind here is that the Census Bureau is made up of predominantly career professionals, but there are specific roles at the Census Bureau that are political appointments. And what's interesting is that the Trump administration has recently appointed three new positions at the Census Bureau, including two brand new deputy director positions that have not been, that didn't exist before, and have raised concerns amongst not only Democratic lawmakers, but professional associations of statisticians, economists, demographers, all the major groups, the researchers, the academics who rely on this information from the Census Bureau and are really concerned that the administration has put in place appointees that their qualifications are unclear, and it's unclear exactly what their roles are. And at this point, I haven't found any specific emails from these appointees. They recently just joined over the past few months. But there are a lot of concerns surrounding what influence they may try to have on this process that is already ongoing in the last stages of conducting this count.
Hansi Lo Wang from NPR, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome, Hari.
Such an important issue there. And finally, how much time do we have left to save the world from climate catastrophe? Well, a clock in Union Square in Manhattan has been programmed to tell us exactly that. The climate clock works as a reminder of the critical window that we have to reverse the devastating effects of global warming. The artist behind it based the timings on calculations from a Berlin research institute. The Earth has a deadline, the clock tells passersby, coming in 7 years and 100 days, after which global temperatures will reach 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial rates. There is still time, but it needs to be used wisely and urgently. That's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.